we've mentioned it a few times, I think now, but this place called CQ Noodle and Bubble Tea in Edmonton that just opened last year, and you and I have gone together. When we were there, I was telling you that they have a braised pork intestine noodle soup dish.
Right.
That piqued your interest, right? You said you were intrigued. I've been back a couple times, and I managed to have that dish, one of them.
Oh, sweet. I'm always intrigued by the like offal dishes on like, well, on any menu really, but especially on Asian menus.
Right.
But I always, for some reason, am still a little bit hesitant to try them sometimes.
Why?
Just like, I don't know. Because I guess like, historically, sometimes I have had some bad experiences having dishes made with like intestine or, you know, maybe some less often eaten organ meats or things like that. Mm-hmm. Because I really do think that like, well, a couple of things. In my experience, most of the like Asian preparations of those types of products are usually like, better than a lot of the European preparations.
Okay.
Hot take. Okay. I don't know. Like I've had some really good, like European incarnations of those types of dishes too. Like, and it's usually in peasant dishes, right? Because it's usually like food that no one wants to go to waste. And so they find a way to use it that makes it palatable or delicious, you know? But I don't know. I think, I don't really know what it is. I don't know if there's like a food history reason for it, but I think that like the Asian dishes that I've tried that use those types of meats or those types of products, like, I don't know, maybe they're just like older and have gone through more iterations to the point where people really understand like what works. But I don't know. I think it's funny. Like when I first started eating tripe in my pho, which took me a little while to try.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, this is weird because it's not like, I don't know, it's more like it's not boiled to the point where it's like super soft or anything like that. Right. They leave it kind of crunchy. And it took me a little while to sort of like get over the texture of that. But like now that I've had it several times.
Like the flavor in the tripe and pho is very mild. Like it just tastes of the broth, right? Like it's not
a challenging flavor. It doesn't taste like much. It's more about the texture for sure. Yeah, it doesn't taste like, I don't know, what are the words that people use to describe like dishes that have tripe in them? Like barnyardy or something like that? I don't know. It doesn't taste like that.
Right.
It basically has no flavor. It's more about the texture, and they cut it into like very thin strips so that it's sort of just like a differently textured noodle or something.
Yeah, totally.
I don't know. I really like it, but you know, it took me a little while to sort of like understand like what it was doing in the dish and why it worked. So I'm, I don't know. I guess I'm just sometimes a little bit hesitant because I think that like, sometimes I've had challenging experiences trying to sort of like understand those types of dishes and why they are the way they are.
Mm-hmm. I think for me, like besides the beef tripe in pho, the most for pork tripe, I think really the only time I've had it is the Polish tripe soup at Continental Treat and some similar dishes that I had in Europe. And that one too, really surprised. It's been ages since I've tasted it, but the Polish tripe soup, I think it's called Flaki or Flaski or something, at Continental Treat was really surprising to me because it was tender and not exactly meaty, but not persistently chewy. Like it was like almost had the texture more of like braised meat than anything else. And just tasted of like garlic, paprika, dried herbs, broth. Like the flavor was very, well, it was delicious and it was approachable.
Right, the aromatic flavor of the soup and not like something, like there was an off flavor or something. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and I find like most of the time, you know, like if there are off flavors in the dish, they're not going to be popular or, you know, they're not going to continue to be ordered and then the restaurant isn't going to continue to prepare them or, you know.
And so I guess I went into the braised pork intestine noodle soup at CQ, expecting it to be kind of like the Polish tripe soup in that it's like it's strips of tripe in a broth, and then there would happen to be noodles as well. It was right. A bit more like, so the noodle bowls there, it's basically like, it's the, you know, wheat-based, alkaline, almost like ramen-esque noodles heaped in a bowl, mm-hmm. soaking in various quantities of a pretty spicy broth and chili oil. And there's some kind of, the dishes just vary basically in the toppings there. So there's ones that have right. ground meat or beans or spare ribs or whatever. And this one was presented basically the same way, where you have that standard noodle bowl. And then it had just the sliced rounds of braised pork intestine, like roughly the size of a tuna, kind of just like on top of the noodles. The flavor was great. They tasted like a Chinese braised meat. Like they had like, I would say like a star anise kind of forward flavor. Sweet. The texture, they were very soft, but they did have like a very subtle chew. It almost, I was trying to think of how to describe it best, but it was almost like, you know, the band of connective tissue around the ribs on short ribs.
Yeah.
It was almost like that, yeah. where it is soft, but yeah, there's a chew to it.
Right.
So that's kind of the best way I could think of to describe it. What was really cool, though, was that I don't know if it was because I ordered this dish or they were just like, if it's meant to go with this dish or if they were just feeling generous. But they brought out a little side plate that had boiled peanuts and slices of dry cured sausage.
Cool.
And I had never had peanuts like that. Like they almost had the texture of they looked bloated, but the texture was like water chestnut, almost like this kind of like vegetal crunch to them.
Where have I heard about that recently? Somebody was talking, was that in a Gold review that we read or something?
Yeah, it was in the heavy noodling review from Counterintelligence.
He was talking about boiled peanuts and yes. then, yeah.
Yeah. And he describes them as bloated, but so I was expecting them to be quite soft and mushy. Like with that, mm-hmm. you know, thinking of boiled, I don't know, but boiled and bloated. But yeah, they were very similar to water chestnut in texture. And then the sausage. So it was a dry cured sausage, but they were describing how it was made. And it's almost like strips of meat and fat are shoved lengthwise into a sausage casing.
Really?
Yeah. And then it's smoked and dried. It was like intensely acridly smoky. Like
crazy.
It was very, very challenging, but it was interesting. And it was, yeah, it was an interesting experience. I loved the peanuts with the noodles. It was a great texture for them, but
did they make that sausage themselves or did they?
I don't know. It seemed homemade to me, but I don't know what, yeah, I have no idea to be honest.
That's cool.
But yeah, big, like the cross section, just like big hunks of lean meat and big hunks of fat side by side.
Yeah.
But yeah, holy cow, the smoke was
a little over the top.
Yeah. The word is acrid for sure. Like it was
acrid. Yeah.
Yeah. Not approachable.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder if that's like intentional. I wonder if you like, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Wonder if they know that it's like that. I wonder if that's authentic. Yeah.
It must be.
Must be.
Yeah.
If it wasn't, then they wouldn't
brag about it.
Serve it to someone and yeah. Mm-hmm.
Welcome to Food Court. I'm Alan Sedeby and I'm here with my good buddy Shale McDonald. How you doing?
Good, Alan.
We're two chefs in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food and we love to talk about it.
Surprise, Alan.
What?
Happy anniversary.
No.
Yeah.
Really? Are you sure? Well, that's embarrassing.
I'm pretty sure.
I didn't get you anything.
I don't know. Like, I know the podcast anniversary is in February, of that much I'm sure, but I don't exactly remember when the date of our first episode was. I can look it up. I love looking things up while we're in the middle of recording the podcast. It's my favorite thing to do. Okay. Oh yeah. Actually, this is like, it's really close. Our first episode ever, episode 001 of Food Court, it's called Food Adjacent. Mm-hmm. And it was released on February 10th, 2021.
Oh, okay.
So this is our 3-year podcast anniversary.
Wow.
Yeah. And we've been, this is our 79th episode. And yeah, so I did some math this morning and and checked how many episodes 78 is. And that's 26 episodes times 3. Okay. And we do 26 episodes a year. So I was like, oh, okay. Well, okay. Yeah.
So the math checks out.
Yeah, so the math checks out. Unfortunately, like I said, it's a surprise that I kind of sprung on you. And so we don't have anything planned in terms of a anniversary plan for this year. I think last year we did do sort of like an anniversary episode, didn't we?
I think so.
Yeah. And I think like we traditionally have done some kind of like anniversary sort of like retrospective or something like that. And I think I'd like to do that again. But yeah, we didn't have it planned for this episode. So that, I guess it might be the next episode.
We've got lots to talk about today.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. We're all good for today.
Okay, happy anniversary.
This is our podcast anniversary. Yeah. On that note, it was sort of my plan this year too on the podcast anniversary to talk about releasing some additional content for avid listeners. We have like a little bit there are some relatively minor but still significant expenses with like having this podcast. There's like some costs for hosting the audio and hosting the website, and a little bit of equipment costs and things like that, and there's some equipment that we'd like to be able to get so that it make it easier for us to have guests on and things like that. And so this year it was my plan to launch a sort of like Patreon for people who want to get a little bit of extra content that they could join up, and I think there's probably like some kind of sliding scale fee. I haven't figured it out yet. But we have been sort of behind the scenes recording a little bit of extra content. Some of it is like Alan and I going through Jonathan Gold reviews and sort of giving our hot takes about them, or talking about the observations that we loved from them. And we're also going to be digging into some recipes out of the Best of Bridge. Mm-hmm. I think like the first year of like extra content, every couple weeks we'll take a look at a recipe in Best of Bridge and probably be like surprised at how well planned out they are and things like that. I've kind of been like leafing through Best of Bridge and have been a little bit shocked at how good some of the recipes are that are in there. You know me, I hate recipes, so right. So yeah, can look forward to that. Hopefully I'll have an announcement about it by our next episode. I have been working on getting the website set up for the Patreon, but I just have had a couple hiccups with work and I was sick in the last couple of weeks, so it was kind of tough for me to get it done by today. But by the end of February I'll have it done and up, and I will put out some information about it on the podcast.
Cool.
We have any other kind of follow-up, Alan?
Yeah, I've got two little pieces of follow-up.
Yeah, excellent.
One is that a friend of the show, Karen, after listening to the heavy noodling episode, gifted us a couple packs of instant noodles.
You sent me pictures. That's
that I'd
awesome.
Like to taste with you. This is again one of those not fully fleshed out follow-ups where we're like, stay tuned for more follow-up. but one of them was a brand that you were familiar with. Was it Ichiran or something, right?
Yeah, that's right. Ichiran is like a ramen chain in Japan. And they're famous in Japan for being the restaurant where you go in and everyone sits at their own individual little booth, and it has like little walls on the side. Oh, really? And there's a curtain in front of you and you order by like filling out your order on a slip of paper, mm-hmm. and then you hand it to a person, and they like, you never talk to anyone, you never see anyone, they're just behind a curtain, and then they bring their soup and like sort of slip it under the curtain. You can talk to someone if there's like a problem with your order, or if you want to. I don't know if it's taboo to just like open the curtain, it may not be, but basically, yeah, everyone has their own individual seat. They don't have like tables where you can sit across from your pals. You just go in and everyone sits in their own little booth along a long counter, and you never speak to anyone, and then they just bring your ramen, and nobody ever, like, you can hear, they like say something when they put down your bowl and stuff like that. But mm-hmm.
So it's tailored for lone diners.
It is. Yeah. It's much less awkward if you go when you're by yourself, right. Because going with your pals, you know, it would be, I think, probably kind of awkward unless you were going there intentionally just to experience that kind of dining. But yeah, right. It's sort of, there are like a lot of Japanese kind of institutions sort of that are set up like that, where it's sort of like easier for you to access a service or something if you're on your own. Mm-hmm. And there are a few reasons for that. I don't necessarily want to dig into them too deep and mm-hmm. derail your follow-up. But yeah, basically it's set up so that you can go in and have a bowl of ramen, which is pretty good. Like, I wouldn't say, like, lots of travelers say, oh, it's the best ramen that I had or something like that. But I certainly wouldn't say that. Mm-hmm. But it's decent. It's serviceable. Like, yeah. it was delicious. I thought it was a good bowl of ramen. And yeah, and then they also, at all of the like gift shops at train stations and at the airport and stuff, Ichiran sells like their
packets,
a box of like, yeah, of instant noodles that you can bring home. And I brought home one 5-pack.
Oh, okay.
when I came home.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
And I made them here. And, you know, obviously I'm pretty sure, well, actually, I don't know. I'm curious to find out if they use... I assume that they don't use their like packaged soup base to make the ramen when you eat it in their shops there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I feel like that would be scandalous or something.
Right.
But the instant ramen comes with their noodles, which are sort of like straight thin noodles, not necessarily the sort of noodles that you would often find in an instant ramen.
Mm-hmm.
And then the soup base is like a tonkatsu pork base, mm-hmm. and it's a liquid in a little pouch, so I think it's like actually reduced pork stock, mm-hmm. and then they just reduce it to the extent that it's like shelf stable, and then mm-hmm. they pasteurize it and put it in a little packet, so mm-hmm. you get like a liquid broth packet,
right?
And when I had it here, it was pretty good. And then I was like, you must just be able to buy this like reduced tonkatsu broth somewhere. And you can't really. It's just not. I'm sure there's probably more than one brand of that in Japan,
mm-hmm.
but I haven't really had much luck finding a place that sells anything like that in North America.
Mm-hmm.
Like plenty of like miso soup bases and other types of soup bases, but I haven't found many like concentrated tonkatsu pork broth bases.
Sounds like something David Chang should work on.
Yeah, maybe.
The other packet.
Anyway.
Sorry.
Oh, sorry. I was working up to just saying one thing about that Ichiran. If you do want to share it, which I'd be happy to do, although if you want to eat it on your own, that's totally okay too. I have plenty of experience eating that instant Ichiran, so mm-hmm. I can definitely talk about it if we want to talk about it on the show.
Okay.
But when I was making it, I was making sides for it. So if you want to get together and eat it together, then maybe one of us can make one side and the other one can, like, I can make ajitama, like ramen mm-hmm. eggs, and mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. you could make some kind of pork something.
Sure.
To put in it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because it is, yeah, it's basically just the base, and I think it comes with like a chili powder and the noodles, which, you know, it tastes good, tastes fine, but it's not really like having a bowl of ramen unless you have some additional garnishes, so.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, and the other one was like a Nissin brand.
Yeah, and one, it was right? interesting because Karen's family is Cantonese, and she said, even though Nissin, it is a Japanese product, I believe, but But she said in Cantonese homes, this is, and restaurants in this, in Western Canada anyways, this was the default instant noodle. These noodles with spam and a fried egg was a very typical weekday dinner in her home growing up. So
sweet.
Yeah.
So I'm going to, so with the Ichiran one, is that something that she also has a lot or something? Or was that just, she happened to have one and she was like, oh, you should try this?
I think the latter, but I actually don't know the, I don't know how she came upon it, but, yeah. So we're going to taste that.
Sweet.
The other bit of follow up was that you were talking about Banh Mi Cali last week and I was able, or sorry, last conversation, and I was able to go and.
Right. And I couldn't remember the name of the owner.
Right.
Which I,
Nicholas.
Nicholas, yeah. Which I do remember now. I went back again after that too, because I felt bad that I couldn't remember his name when we were talking about it.
Yeah. And it's, definitely not the gentleman that that was working there every time that I had been previous,
right. Okay.
New guy, young guy, there with, also with, a second young employee. And yeah, bit of a different vibe. They had R&B playing. There was more people in there than I'd ever seen. The sandwich is still, I had a house special, obviously. And yeah, it seemed, it was still excellent. I think that maybe it's bigger than it has been.
Right.
It seemed like I think the portion size.
Yeah, the ones that I've gotten there since Nicholas has been back is a little bit bigger than I had been getting before.
Same wonderful head cheese that we've talked about. I was able to confirm that they make it in house. He said it's his grandmother's recipe. I think from Vietnam, but by way of California. I think he said that she grew up in California, which is maybe, probably why the business is named Cali.
Right. Well, that's interesting.
One thing that was definitely different, and I don't know, I'm scared to bring it up because it's going to sound weird, but the mayonnaise was unusually thick, thick that I would speculate that maybe it had some kind of animal fat in it. Like it was
that's
thick, like almost like waxy, which is I sometimes casually remark on the mayonnaise in, say, like the mayonnaise that they use at Nanwa. It's just like it's a little bit yellowish and it's a little bit sweet, and so it's not right. Hellman's for sure.
Right. No, I think it's made I'm pretty sure it's made in house, because I've never seen, like, in the Asian grocery store, I've never seen like a Vietnamese mayonnaise that I, you know, so.
And so, yeah, I've never really given much thought to the mayonnaise at Banh Mi Cali, but this one sandwich, and I'll have to go back and see if it wasn't just a
fluke,
a one-off theory. But yeah, it was very different, and tasty. And there was loads of it. There was gobs of it in a good way.
Yeah, he also makes the pâté as well, which is like a little bit rougher than I think that, than you find in a lot of places, but really tasty, like a little bit more rustic, I guess, like in texture, but really tasty.
Yeah.
So yeah,
it was a wonderful sandwich. It was good.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely it's a really good sandwich, and it's also like, there are like Nanwa and Van Lock. I also really like the Banh Mi there, and they are a little bit different than you get at Nanwa. I feel like Nanwa is very representative. It's like a high level representation of like the sort of like what's the word, like the commodity Banh Mi,
okay,
or something, like the Banh Mi that you get at like every Banh Mi shop. Nanwa is like a high level version of that, like very sort of like basic. And I don't know how it compares to Vietnam, because I've never been there, but like the sort of like I've gotten Banh Mi in, like, all over Western Canada, and that's sort of like usually what you get.
Yep.
And Nanwa does that at a pretty high level. Van Lock and Banh Mi Cali, I think, are doing something a little bit different. And Van Lock is like a little bit different and really good, but Banh Mi Cali is like quite a bit different, quite a bit different from what you normally expect when you go to a Banh Mi shop. And I really like that. I'm really digging it. And Nicholas is very friendly and is happy to talk about like any of the details of the sandwich and
yep.
and how the business is doing and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, definitely. If you're a listener and you haven't checked out Bon Mikali, now's a good time, I feel like.
Yep, totally.
Yeah. It's kind of like having like a mini sort of like a mini renaissance. And the owner is like really excited to be there. And I think he's like really putting a lot of heart and soul into the food. And that's mm-hmm. awesome. Mm-hmm.
That's all I had for follow-up.
Makes me want to go there for lunch today, Alan.
Depends how long we talk here, Shil.
Okay. All right, let's make it quick.
So now for the principal discussion.
The main course.
We're going to talk about the menu that we're running this term at Earnest, so our winter 2024 menu. And we've done mm-hmm. this not quite every term, but almost every term we have a discussion of the menu.
Yeah.
It might be our last one, Shil, because I don't think I'll be teaching this course in the fall.
Whoa, really?
Yeah. I might.
That's
yeah.
big/surprising news.
They usually rotate the instructors every 3 years.
Oh, okay.
And I've been there for 3.5 years, so.
So it's not necessarily a big surprise to you then?
No, no.
Oh, okay.
But we can do a, when I know my assignment for the fall, I can, if necessary, I can do a little bit of a reflection on my time in this lab. And
evening dining?
Yeah, serving yeah. Serving dinners at Earnest. But, did you see, I sent you a copy of the menu. Did you get that or did it go to your spam?
Yeah, I okay, have it cool. here in front of me, Alan.
Okay.
Earnest Dining Room, winter 2024.
Yes. So here we go.
Sure. I think, I mean, maybe a couple of high level things before we get into it. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk a little bit about like the structure of how you're putting out the menu is a little bit different this term, right? Because the size of the class and the length of the term changed a little bit. Do you want to touch on that at all? Or
sure, we can. We made a bunch of small changes. It wasn't really they're not as dramatic as I had expected, but basically we have smaller, much smaller classes, fewer students right. at any given time. And they spend less time in this lab. So
right.
historically I've had say between 12 and 16 students who are there for 4.5 weeks.
Right.
This term it's close. It's usually 8 students and they're only there right. for 3 full weeks. Which right. means that they
so you
only
get smaller
do...
groups for a shorter period of time and then they rotate out and then you get another small group.
Yeah, that's right. And so that means that they only do 12 services because we only do service Tuesday through Friday.
Right.
So the worries or my concerns knowing that were one, with fewer hands, would production and service be an issue with the types of dishes that we want to serve because it's supposed to be a fine dining experience? Would they have sufficient time to learn the dishes, to learn the preparations?
Right.
And so the changes that we made, first of all, the menu is a little bit smaller, not dramatically so, but historically we've done 6 starters and 6 mains. Right off the bat, mm-hmm. I just reduced that to 5 and 5. So it makes production a little bit easier. One other thing that's kind of, I guess it's unfortunate, but I tried to wrap my head around operating our brigade with only 3 stations, but to right. have like the coursed meals that were intended to serve and the complexity of dishes, I didn't think that was possible. And so we still have the 4 brigade stations, garde-manger, a chef saucier, rôtisse, and entremetier. But then to rotate through 4 stations in only 3 weeks, you know,
yeah,
like 4 stations tough. With 12 services, it just seemed way too quick. And it's just like as soon as they start to understand mm-hmm. the station, they're on to the next one. And so one big change is that even though there are 4 brigade stations, the students only get a chance to work 3 of them.
Right. Oh yeah.
And we try and like be flexible.
Do you give them a choice of
not
do you
not,
do you no
not really. Currently. I do say in the orientation, like if you, for instance, you're not on rôtisse for this term, but you really want to see how we process and dry age the ducks, which we talked about last week. Let me know. We'll figure it out. We'll give you a chance to
right.
to do that. Having had already, because we're 4 weeks into term, we've already had 1 rotation of students. And I asked them mm-hmm. specifically on the last day, like, Was it a bummer that you didn't get to do all the stations? And generally, no one had a problem with it, because right. They get to, like, if you work the full week on one station, at the end of the week, you really feel like you know it inside out and backwards, and they
right.
they do a good service.
And that's better.
It's worked so far.
And in the case of a lot of students, especially the keeners or the ones who are like really curious, they probably, you know, they're working their station, but they're probably keeping an eye on other people's stations too. And they're probably asking questions and, you know, maybe talking with their fellow students about the station that they're on and stuff. And so you get some exposure to it regardless, right?
Yeah. And the only other change, we spent a little bit more time than usual trying to simplify, because the most difficult station for service is always Entre Métiers, because, you know, for Rotis, every dish has one protein on it. So every guest, Rotis only has to cook one thing per guest. But Entre Métiers usually has two or three things. It would be like maybe two kinds of veg and a starch, or like a veg, a starch, and wilted spinach or kale or something.
It's just not fair, Alan.
Yeah.
You have to disrupt your conception of what can go on what station. Maybe there's a vegetable that can go on Rotis.
Yeah, and we have done stuff like that. Like what's an example? If we had a pork belly and cornbread dish, I don't know if you remember, you ate that one actually ages ago.
Yeah.
But like, we made Rotis bake cornbread because we knew that on the line, we wanted them to fry that cornbread in the rendered fat from the pork belly. So I don't, we definitely blur the lines if it makes sense for service and it makes sense for the distribution of prep. But what we did on Entremet this term, like for instance, there's three components that come out of the deep fryer. and that's because it makes their service much easier. Because like if everything's coming out of a pan, then it's easy to get bogged down. They only have six burners on their station, six burners and a French top.
Yeah.
And so being able to just drop something in the fryer, like we have a potato preparation that we'll talk about later. We have some chickpea hush puppies that we'll talk about later, and a carrot side that they're cooked in duck fat, and so we just deep fry them to retherm them. And trying to simplify, like for instance, more of the starches than usual are actually held in a steam table. So things like mash and squash puree and stuff like that.
Oh, okay.
So Entre Métiers can just heat a bunch of these at the start of service and actually put them in a steam table on the chef station for plating. So it's still a challenging station, but it's much simpler than, much more streamlined than it has been in the past. Yeah, but otherwise it really is, like when you read the menu, I think it's basically the same type of dish and the same customer experience from all the menus past.
Yeah, well, I think like winter menus and winter food also lend themselves to having more components that are, I don't know, just like more stable when you retherm them, or that are less prone to having a degradation in quality if you hold them hot for any period of time and things like that. Things like in summer menus where you're like trying to preserve like the freshness and color of things, you know, like especially the green color of things, you know, like that can be really tricky. But for like heartier fare and like more sort of like wintry types of preparations, there's a lot more that you can kind of get away with if you, that's the wrong way of putting it, but
right. I just mean, yeah.
Because a lot of the foods are in a way like, you know, the seasonal aspect of eating a winter menu is often eating a lot of preserved foods, right? Mm-hmm. Because you're trying to eat the food that you've put up for the winter in a lot of cases. And that's sort of like the, I don't know, historical kind of basis for, you know, what winter, the feel of eating a winter menu is kind of like,
right.
You know, a lot of those foods tend to like confits and things like that and braises and stuff like that. And then also with the vegetable preparations, like more pickles and more preserved things, you know, yeah, they just tend to hold up a lot better, you know, when you subject them to some of those like, you know, like longer hot holding and things like that. They don't degrade in quality.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's good for streamlining for the winter menu. I don't know what that's going to be like in the spring, but
That's one thing. I think there's definitely some very wintry dishes on this menu. There was a two or three dishes though where I was just like, I've wanted to do this for ages. I know it's not seasonal for where we live, but I have access to great products, and so I'm just going to do it, even though it some of them will read very much like late summer dishes. Like there's a ratatouille, for instance, on the menu.
Oh, but, yeah, I see that.
Okay, can I tell you about the soup?
Yeah, Alan, tell me about the soup. Let's get into it.
I think that we've talked about this idea before on the show, but I could not tell you what the broader conversation was. But
okay,
the menu says cream of mushroom soup with crispy root vegetables and chive.
Okay.
What the...
Immediately, I'm thinking approachable.
Yes. But okay, so the kernel of the idea for the soup is the actual official name that I gave it, like in my head and in my notebook, is mushroom soup sous feuille. So mushroom soup under leaves.
Right, right, right.
And so...
Oh, yeah, yeah, I remember we've talked about this.
Yeah, and we were able to, we served this at a chef's, like a tasting menu last term, and it went over well. And so we just put it on the regular menu. But the idea is that it's a very simple mushroom soup, and we make really delicate, crispy root vegetables. We have red beet, golden beet, parsnip, carrot, that kind of thing. Made in the, we discussed the technique with the parsnip crisps that were served on the agnolotti that you had in the fall. It was like, we're shaving them thin with a peeler, tossing them in a tiny bit of cornstarch, and then frying them at a very low temperature. So they get super brittle, but not too dark. They still have the bright colors of the root veg.
They still have color. Yeah.
And we just cover the mushroom soup with those, and it looks like fallen leaves on a forest floor in autumn.
Right.
And then to accentuate that theme, it's not on the descriptive copy, but we pickle little tiny beach mushrooms, like shimeji mushrooms, and put them in the leaves there as well. So it looks like mushrooms in the forest. And then we have little lengths of chive. So like that kind of look like grass or whatever.
Do you have them sticking up?
No, we're not that precious about it, but we could. We could. I mean, for a tasting menu, a fancy, like a chef's table or something, we probably would take the time to do that. But, and also when we've served it in the past, we've added truffle oil to the mushroom soup. We don't do that for our regular menu, just because we want it, like you said, to be just tasty and approachable. And not that truffle oil is not tasty, but it's not everybody's cup of tea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. And I don't know. It is tasty, but I feel like it's dangerous. You know, like it's tricky to get the right amount.
Right. And that's another.
You know, it's easy for it to be overpowering.
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, and I feel like it's the kind of thing where newer cooks want to use a lot of it.
Right.
Or something.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. So that's soup.
Cool. And it's working out well, you think?
Yeah, it sells very well. It's the, I don't.
Yeah.
To me, even the title cream of mushroom soup just sounds kind of plain and dated, but it sells very well. And it's a pretty plate and it tastes great. So yeah, I'm very happy to have it on the menu.
Yeah. Have you gotten much customer feedback about it? Are people like, I ordered mushroom soup and I got like... a bowl of chips.
Literally the first time we served it, in the new year, the first time that we served it, that was the first thing that the first woman who ate the soup said was that there were too many chips. And then I was like, oh, people aren't going to get this. But then after that, I haven't heard anything like that. It's been overwhelmingly positive. And the staff who have eaten it said it's great and that people are usually surprised when it comes to the table.
That's cool.
So yeah, I'm happy.
I don't know. I like, I'm split. I like your original name idea. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I would, you know, use the French incarnation of it or something, but it would kind of be nice if you were able to like have the name on the menu still be approachable, but still like, you know, kind of, I don't know, just be a through line for the conceptual idea of it, you know, because yeah, if people don't understand that that's what the concept is, then they might be like, why did they put chips all over my soup? Which I'm sure a lot of people are. And they don't think about it enough or long enough to realize that it's like meant to look like a forest floor or something like
that. And so would you, because it took me ages to, like years probably, to think of that term mushroom soup sous foy. Because yeah. in my head I was like, well, you can't, like, it sounds gross if you just say it's like forest floor mushroom soup.
Forest floor, like, yeah,
that,
no,
that doesn't gross. Sound good. Yeah. So do you think that mushroom soup under leaves, like in quotation marks under leaves, would be, or with autumn,
like,
leaves?
I understand your hesitation here, I think. Yeah. Like, it does sound kind of pretentious.
Yes.
And I feel like you probably would have less people order it.
Yes.
Like,
absolutely.
You know, because it sounds pretentious, people would be like, I don't know.
I just want soup, you know? Man.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. It's so tricky. I think, I guess, if I had the option, and you may or may not really have this option, but like, I would probably try to leave the name of it simple on the menu like this, mm-hmm. but have the server, when they bring it, just have a really simple, like, little script that outlines the concept.
Right. Yeah.
You know, or something.
Yeah, could be. I mean, that could work.
Yeah. As long as the server doesn't then make it sound pretentious. But I guess it's too late once they've ordered it. So
I just know that's a dangerous, it's dangerous when you have to provide that context as you're serving and you explain the chef's inspiration, that can quickly become overbearing for sure. And I know.
Totally agree. Yeah. It has to be like a really quick, simple thing that somebody can say that's like easy to remember and isn't like an overly long story about how the chef was walking through the forest.
Yes,
and
exactly. That's exactly what I wouldn't want. Yeah.
Yeah, no. It has to be like, I think something scripted that's like really quick and easy that just sort of like touches on the concept so that people are like, oh yeah, that's cute.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I just immediately have like memories of, say, reading reviews of North 53 where they just rant and rave about, oh, well, the servers just shut up and let me eat the food.
Right, right.
And I know Nate and Erica had comments about that, like that from 11 Massam Park, where they're being served like squash that's baked in seaweed or kelp or something, and this ridiculous story of Daniel Hume driving down an ocean road and smelling the ocean and seeing the squash in the fields, and they were like, give
it's
me
so
a break. Anyways, okay, enough about
not that it's probably not true.
Well, yeah, but
it's just that, like, you know,
get over yourself.
Can we eat it?
Does it taste good?
Then,
yeah,
you know, yeah. If I have questions about it afterwards, mm-hmm. then can I ask you, like, hey, what was the inspiration for this?
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For the quote unquote salad course, I really wanted to use, even though it's February, I really wanted to use baby hothouse cucumbers because they are now, mm-hmm. they're in every grocery store all year round. And actually a lot of them are Alberta grown, like from Southern Alberta.
Yeah.
And so, and I just love them. Like, they're adorable. They have fantastic texture, really fresh, crunchy, not as watery as full grown cucumbers.
Yeah.
And they're kind of everywhere right now. Like, they're like the Chinese style smashed cucumber salad, like we always get that at Bao Bao. And I think there's a version of like a smashed cucumber on the menu at Bira right now. Anyways.
Yeah.
So this one is very Scandinavian, but it's just called smashed cucumbers on the menu with the copy baby hothouse cucumbers, skyr, Icelandic rye, pickled shallot, and dill.
Very Icelandic.
Yeah. There's also radishes on it. So it's kind of.
Where are you getting the skyr?
From Superstore.
Oh, okay.
And I can't remember the brand now, but it's like a common brand. They just happen to have skyr on the shelves all the time now.
Cool. I didn't realize that.
There was talk of, we'll talk about it later, but they have a dedicated employee at Nate now who just does cultured dairy and cheese production. For use in-house and for, we've never talked about this, but there's a little artisan market that opened on the campus where they sell meat, cheese, pastries, sausages, all kinds of stuff that's coming out of the culinary labs, ice cream even.
Cool.
So anyways, the process here, so we cut and smash the baby cucumbers, mm-hmm. generous salt, some homemade apple cider vinegar. So it's not like a formal vinaigrette. It's literally just salt and vinegar and a little bit of caraway seed.
Are you marinating them in that at all? Or are you just doing it at service time and they sit in it for like a minute?
We do it They make a bunch at the start of service and then just keep on top of it so that it has some time. Like we want the cucumbers to release some other liquid and
marinate
stuff.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Macerate. Yeah. Is that the right word?
I think a lot of people would say that. I think
with salt,
technically maceration has to involve alcohol according to LaRousse, but,
oh, okay.
But
okay.
I would definitely use that term as well. And then, yeah, we're piping a little bit of this skyr onto the plate. The Icelandic rye. So someone who's been, he worked with me in evening dining a little bit in the fall. And then he has been with me in the new year, as a ed lab tech. But he's soon mm-hmm. transitioning into being, a full-time instructor, but he is Red Seal cook, Red Seal baker. And he made this Icelandic rye that I had never heard of this, but it's apparently a very traditional preparation that historically would have been, you make this rye, batter, and then it gets put in a pot and buried close to a geyser or like some kind of geothermally active area. And it stays in there for 24 hours.
Oh, and you guys have all that geothermal heating right next to the school in the Blatchford district or whatever that the city is building, yeah. right?
Well, actually, there's also a button on the rationale. You just press Icelandic geyser.
Geyser.
But yeah, we make it in the rationale, and it does have a very long, very low temperature bake. And so there's like kind of enzymatic browning that happens. And so it comes out very dark.
So can you tell me a little bit about it? Is it similar to like a Danish, like seeded rye bread or something like that? Or I'm not quite sure what you mean by Icelandic rye. I'm curious.
So yeah, you're going to make me pronounce an Icelandic word. This is going to be embarrassing. The
not necessarily.
The traditional, like the Icelandic word for it is rugbraud. So
right.
R-U-G-B-R-A-U-D, although some of those letters have accents that I don't understand.
I'm pretty sure that means rye bread.
Okay. Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
But it has, we're using pumpernickel and rye and all-purpose flour. It's very sweet. Okay. There's a lot of sugar in it.
So it's all flour. It's not like whole grains.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay.
Like the pumpernickel is processed. Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah. And the rye is flour as well.
Yeah.
It's not.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, it has baking powder, salt, milk powder, and water.
Oh, okay. So it's baking powder leavened.
Yes. Yeah. What's really distinct about it is the bake. So we do, I think, 220 Fahrenheit for 24 hours.
Wow.
So it's very, very low and slow.
Yeah, that's like just above the boiling point.
Yeah. And then it gets, yeah, like a very distinct dark crust on it. And yeah, we chill it and cube it. And it's quite shelf stable. Like I think it's, if you...
What type of form do you bake it in?
We bake it in a 7-quart stainless steel pot with the lid on.
Oh, crazy.
Yeah, so I don't like traditionally, I don't know what would have been used, but this is just what makes the most sense for us for the size that we want and what's available to us. So
cool.
So skyr, little cubes of this Icelandic rye, the smashed vinegary, salty, caraway-y cucumbers, some little rounds of radish, dill oil and dill leaves, and pickled shallot.
Cool.
So yeah, as long as it's seasoned properly, it's got plenty of salt, acid from the vinegar and the pickles, some bright colors with the dill oil.
Yeah, sounds great. Sounds like it's probably one of the less expensive things on the menu, food cost wise.
Oh, totally. Yep. So one thing we had talked last week about, I was hell-bent on having dry aged duck as a main this term. We don't have dry aged duck available to us commercially. And so it means bringing in whole ducks, and we knew we were going to be, have lots of duck legs. And so there had to be a use for that on the menu. And so we put a rillette en terrine. So, and this is another thing we've talked about 100 times, like the idea of making a rillette in a terrine and then capping it with something instead of the traditional fat, like either the reduced jus from the confit or a gelée that's set with gelatin.
Gelée. Yeah.
The menu reads pork and duck confit, rosemary, walnut crisps, hascap, and pickled vegetables. Yum. originally I wasn't sure what the balance was going to be between, you know, dry aged duck breast production and duck legs being turned into confit. And so I figured if we didn't have enough duck leg meat, we would also add pork confit to the rillette. It turns out that the duck breast sells well enough that
you have more than enough.
Yes, we have more than enough. It's actually so far it worked out quite as quite a good balance. So right now, for instance, we don't have pork in the rillette. It's all duck.
Do you have to reprint the menu, or do you just? Well,
we just verbally tell the guest tonight. Oh, tonight's 100% duck. It's a very simple and classic rillette. And it's capped with Hascap gelée. So Hascap juice with gelatin. And so it's got a nice...
Does that bleed into the surface of the rillette at all?
A tiny bit. I was very worried about that. And actually, one thing we found is that if you can picture slicing the rillette, the gut reaction, or sorry, the intuitive thing to do is to just like have the gelée cap on top and you slice down through the gelée and then through the meat.
Right.
There is a little bit of smearing that happens with that. So it drags the, because like the pigment in the Hascap is really concentrated, right? Like it's very dark.
Yeah. Super intense. It's like, it's probably more, I don't know, like colorful or like, intensely colored than like beet. Juice, even
it's on the
I would
same
say.
Order, and it's so dramatic because people always compare them to blueberries, but blueberries inside, like most grapes, they're like clear, the pulp and jelly and
clear
stuff
inside,
is clear, but for Hascaps it's not. It's colored all throughout. But anyways, we found that if you turn the terrine on its side, like turn the unmolded rillette en terrine on its side, so that the Hascap gelée is on the vertical side. And then cut it that way so your knife isn't smearing it through the meat. You can get a very clean distinction between the gelée and the terrine. If it sits in if it's unmolded and sliced and then sits in the cooler for more than a couple of days, then the staining becomes a little bit more pronounced. But
cool. Yeah, that sounds great.
The rosemary walnut crisps are like homemade. Raincoast style.
Raincoast crisps.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what I was picturing.
So it has walnuts, pumpkin seeds, cranberries, and rosemary. So you get a few of those. And then for the pickled vegetables, we're just taking some pickled items from other menu items. So the little pickled mushrooms from the soup, those are going on this plate as well.
Oh yeah.
And the pickled shallots from the cucumber dish are on this plate. And then we just finish it with a little salad of microgreens. We typically have red radish sprouts on hand, like those purple radish sprouts.
So the pickles, it's all quick pickles.
Yes. Yeah. I was a little apprehensive about how this dish would sell, partly because most people don't know what rillette is. And then even once it's described,
like, or terrine.
Yeah. And so like, it's not, some of our cold, like pate type dishes have struggled to move in the past. This one sells quite well. So
that's good.
Yeah.
I imagine it's delicious. I'm having sort of like the same struggle that I have whenever we read through one of your menus. Like I want to come and try it,
totally.
But I basically want to try everything.
Right.
And then I'm like trying to make a plan for what I would order, you know, like if it was a busy night and you weren't able to like make me small portions of whatever, which you have done in the past, which has been awesome. Mm-hmm. Still haven't, I don't know. Maybe there was one time I tried everything on the menu, but like that's
silly.
Difficult. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I'm like trying to make a plan in my head for what I would order, and it's not going well.
Yeah. We have a really good, I've talked about this before, where like usually there's projects that the students in the class have to do. So they have to prepare a prefix menu or prepare an hors d'oeuvre. And I've started to use those as kind of like workshopping future menu ideas. And so I'll have like the kernel of some idea and I'll explain it to the student. I say, now it's yours. Like just run with it, finish it, do whatever you want. But I want to see like whatever it is, this protein with this sauce or something like that. And about a year ago, I gave a very broad instruction where it was just that the the appetizer on a prefix menu needed to be a salmon tartare. And I didn't have anything more specific than that, but they
right.
came back with, it was a salmon tartare that was served in a tomato dashi consomme, like a cold okay. tomato dashi consomme with melon and, caviar, like salmon caviar.
So it's served in a bowl. The consomme is like sitting at the bottom of the bowl. And then there's like a quenelle of the salmon tartare or something. And then the garnish is on top of that, or some of the garnish is around in the consomme.
Exactly. Yeah. Like they didn't use a quenelle. Yeah, they did. I think for the salmon was actually cut quite coarse, and it was just kind of a tidy mound of it in the middle. We have a round bowl, and we put a 2.5-inch ring mold or in the center, press our gotcha. Salmon tartare into that, and then pour the consomme around it. But just yeah. the flavors, sorry. So it's a very striking presentation because it's like a very clear consomme, but the flavors mm-hmm. like salmon, tomato, dashi were so, and melon, I don't know. It was something I had never seen specifically, but it tasted yeah. so good. And it makes sense. Like salmon, tomato, dashi, I don't know.
It makes a lot of sense.
Really smitten with it. And so it took me about a year, but we finally have a version of it on the menu.
Is it a, what do you call that? A freeze clarified tomato consomme?
I was talking, with the other person in the class, Anthony, about that. So far we've only done the like classical egg white clarification. I had been thinking about that a lot, because in the second 11 Madison Park cookbook, they do a lot of egg white clarification, but with not traditional, like meat based hot consommes. I can't think of an right. example right now, but there were a few in there. And so I was like, oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. I've never really thought about it as a broader clarification outside method. Of the context yeah. of hot soup. So anyways, that was in the back of my mind. And then these students just did it. And it was awesome. But yeah, it would be a good... The only thing would be to do that freeze, like the... What's the name for that method?
I can't remember. Like, and when I was going to bring it up, I was like racking my brain to actually remember what it's called.
So the thing is that
basically
in a nutshell, the technique is you take a gelatin-rich broth... And mm-hmm. then you usually lay it out in a pan and freeze it, and then lay it yep. in cheesecloth and put it in the fridge
That's right.
to slowly thaw overnight, or partially thaw, I guess. And what happens is at fridge temperature, the gelatin content of the stock is still solid, and it makes a kind of yep. matrix through which the water component of the stock filters through, and you end up with
exactly.
brilliantly crystalline clear... a clear stock.
Yeah, and somewhat concentrated too. Mm-hmm. I think because the gelatin holds on to a fair amount of the water as well. Like it holds on to the particulate, but it also holds on to, because like the gelatin gets hydrated during the process of it setting up mm-hmm. or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so the gelatin matrix also hangs on to a fair portion of the water that's in it too, so right. the clarified liquid that you get tends to be somewhat concentrated as well.
And then but the one issue with that technique is that if you want to serve that as a hot soup, there's now no gelatin in it, and so it might have kind of a watery mouthfeel, and so you would have to back add gelatin if that's the mouthfeel that you want.
If that's the mouthfeel that you want, yeah. But I find like it's usually used in contexts where it tends to be used in contexts where it's like you want like a very clean, clear tasting liquid that mm-hmm. isn't necessarily like, you know,
doesn't necessarily
have like a lot of gelatin in the mouthfeel,
right.
but yeah.
And then for us to do it,
like I've never seen it used for clarifying meat stocks, cause there's just better ways to do that.
I see.
I feel like, you know, yeah.
So then we would have to add, cause the tomato dashi consomme, as we make it right now, we basically make like a very tomato-y veg broth. Mm-hmm. And then add at the very end of simmering, take it off heat and add the kombu and the katsuboshi for the dashi,
right.
the dashi element. And then strain it, chill it, and then do our egg white clarification. So we would need to add gelatin to that, but that wouldn't be like, we could add fish gelatin to it and it wouldn't affect our, you know, the dietary issue because it's being served with fish anyways.
Right.
But that's what you would do, right? Yeah. You'd have to add gelatin to it.
If you want that mouthfeel.
But I mean, even to do the clarification.
Oh, I see. Right? Like if you wanted to do the frozen clarification thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we would just add.
You would have to add gelatin. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is there a version of
that? Yeah, you would add like synthetic gelatin or whatever. Yeah. Right. Like,
is there a version of that works with agar?
I don't know. Maybe. I don't know, actually. That's a good question. Because like, I know the reason why it works so well with gelatin is because like, if you put gelatin in the fridge or whatever, that gelatin matrix is really good at hanging on to the water, mm-hmm. right? And that's why it gels and it turns into like a jello-y structure and it just stays in the format that it's in. Mm-hmm. But when you put it in the freezer, the water crystals break the gelatin matrix, mm-hmm. right? The water, like when the water freezes, it turns into sharp crystals and that like on a microscopic level breaks up the gelatin matrix. So like on a physical level, it's still sort of hanging together and like large particles and stuff can still be stuck in it. But basically it's so full of holes that like most of the water just drains out. So if you've ever frozen Jell-O and then you take it out of the freezer, it just like breaks. Mm-hmm. It's not pleasant.
Right. Yeah.
And I don't think that would work the same way with agar, but I'm not positive. I don't remember. Mm-hmm. I'm sure I've read something about that in the reading that I've done about that method, but mm-hmm. I don't remember off the top of my head.
Okay, I'm going to look into it.
But yeah, agar would be vegan or vegetarian. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, which isn't important for this particular dish, but it would be cool to have a vegan way to do that clarification.
So to do that kind of clarification. Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. Totally. Yeah, I'm really curious about that. I like the dashi idea in there, bringing some umami to extra umami to like the tomato broth. Like that sounds, everything sounds really great. Mm. I would say melon. What kind of melon are you using? Cantaloupe?
Right now we're using honeydew.
Okay. Yeah. Cantaloupe or honeydew. I don't know. Tell me if this is like wild, but like cantaloupe and honeydew, I think cantaloupe even more so, especially when it's at the ripeness mm-hmm. has a lot of umami.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
Am I wrong about that? I don't know. It just feels like it's one of the most umami rich fruits that there is to me or something. Yeah. It's like almost savory, like verging on savory in this, like really, it's got like this weird savory complexity, but it's like sweet and delicious. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I feel like that works really well.
I don't know if it's just like the fruit that we have available to us in Edmonton, but I mean, if I had to pick between the two of them to only eat one for the rest of my life, like cantaloupe, hands down. The honeydew is much blander, at least the ones that we get.
I agree. Cantaloupe has a more complex flavor profile, I think. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if I had to choose between two of them sitting on the shelf and one was ripe and one wasn't. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to choose the ripe one.
Mm-hmm. Well, the menu just says melon, so I can try both.
Do whatever you want. Exactly. Yeah.
Watermelon? No.
Probably not. I don't know. Like it could work in the spring/summer. That could work in this dish, but yeah.
I don't know about the tomato element, but like I could see watermelon and dashi and fish. There is that yeah. Ahu.
Watermelon. I think there is a tomato watermelon connection too. I don't know. I feel like I've used that before.
We've talked about the tomato melon. Not specifically watermelon, but we've talked about the tomato melon thing before. Because I had a salad where I specifically wanted to put melons and tomatoes on it. It was a quinoa salad,
right?
Because I think I saw it in a cookbook, but mm-hmm. yeah, watermelon doesn't make as much sense to me as cantaloupe. Yeah. But I don't know.
I feel like, you know, there's that like really popular like watermelon carpaccio idea that like blew up and was everywhere for a while. It's like compressed pieces of watermelon, like but plated like a carpaccio.
Okay.
I feel like that was on every like fine dining menu for a while.
Oh, is that right? Like recently?
Like not that recently. Like I don't know, 12-15 years ago or something like that. 10-12 years ago maybe.
We definitely had a watermelon salad at Jack's, but it wasn't the carpaccio. It was like grilled watermelon with feta something. Yeah. I can't remember.
But I feel like in that watermelon carpaccio context, you could do something where you like layered it with tomato and it would be,
yeah,
like if they were both compressed or something like that you would have, that there's something there.
Okay.
But
write down.
Like there would be a surprising flavor thing happening or something.
Right.
I don't know.
The other thing that's not, we changed, or we added it after the menu was printed, but there's ponzu. There's a little bit of ponzu in the salmon tartare, and we made ponzu pearls. So on this, there's like salmon caviar, and then there's also ponzu pearls. So it's like two different kinds of, it's like the oysters and pearls conceit from Keller, right? Like it's like there's tapioca balls and there's caviar, and they have similar sizes, but different textures and stuff. But yeah.
Right. So the salmon caviar looks like salmon caviar, obviously. And then if you're making ponzu caviar, does it have like a kind of like a brown?
Yeah, it's the color of soy sauce. Yeah.
Yeah. So then that would look more like sturgeon caviar or something like that.
I guess so. More like. Yeah. Yeah. I
don't know.
Anyways. Yeah. I love stealing it when students have good ideas and I get to steal them. It's great.
Yeah, exactly. It's amazing. It feels good to have someone that you're working with, you know, to feel like they have the freedom to come up with a good idea and come up with one. And then, you know, like I think I've talked about it on the show before, but I read a book called Creativity Inc. was by like the studio head of Pixar.
Right.
Who I don't think he's Ed Catmull, I think is his name.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he's still the studio head of Pixar. But, you know, he talks a lot about how the perception of creativity is that, like, you know, it's one person with this great idea and they just, you know, like they fight to like bring this idea to fruition.
Right.
But in reality, it's like an environment that you can create where people within it can contribute. And when that is happening and those types of things are firing on all cylinders, like that's when you get like the real, I don't know, the real inspired creativity. Like, I don't know, like when you think of artistic movements, like, you know, a lot of artists were working in conjunction with their contemporaries or commenting on each other's pieces and things like that. And that sort of like artistic, I wouldn't call it competition, but like conversation is like, I think where real creativity comes from and the conceit that like creativity is like a singular auteur driven sort of idea is I don't know, a little bit unrealistic and kind of demeaning to collaboration or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway,
there's
my rant.
That's in a way it's the way that history is taught does a disservice to us in that regard, where it's like something like, say, Isaac Newton, obviously a genius, but like they make it sound like he just pulled calculus out of the air, but really like other other mathematicians like Leibniz and stuff on the continent were working on the same ideas, and
they were having conversations about it and writing letters back and forth. And there were ideas in those letters that percolated through the Royal Society. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people were aware of those concepts while they were happening.
Yeah.
That's a classic example.
Yes, totally. And then I think usually it's
the Newton Leibniz.
Usually afterwards, like someone like Newton will try and like destroy the correspondence
hopefully not. Like I would hope in most cases that there's not one person that's like, no, it's my idea. But
it's happened.
Yeah.
The last appetizer is called Nate Ricotta Gnocchi. And this is, we've done a version of this dish where the central concept is that we're making ricotta on site. It produces an ungodly amount of whey. And we want to find a way to use the whey at the same rate that we produce cheese. And so we make ricotta gnocchi and then we reduce the whey significantly, like at least by half.
Right.
Or sorry, I can't remember if we're doing by half or by three quarters, but and then make a sauce with that. So in the past, we've had like a spring version of this where it was ricotta gnocchi, just like served in broth basically, but the broth is reduced whey with a little bit of lemon. And then we'll serve in the springtime. It was like peas and chive oil and pea shoots and stuff in there. This is like a winter version. The descriptive copy here, winter squash, preserved lemon, whey, and thyme. I think that's a little bit different than what I sent you, but we make
mine doesn't say preserved lemon. Right.
So we make an emulsified sauce of the whey reduction, and a bit of cheese and preserved lemon. So it's quite, well, it's sour and it tastes like preserved lemon.
Cool.
And then the ricotta gnocchi is tossed with some seared squash, butternut squash, with that sauce. Wilt a little bit of black kale into it and serve it and put like pan grattato on top of it, like fried breadcrumbs, basically.
Sweet. Does the whey have a sweetness as well?
Yeah, totally. It's surprising. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So you get like kind of sour, sweet sort of vibe in the sauce. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the gnocchi is just a standard, it's ricotta, flour, egg. That's it.
I feel like we're in the same position that we're always in this when we talk about your menu, and that's that, like,
we finish the appetizers.
If we don't want this to be a 3-hour episode of the show, then we like have to blast through the mains.
Yeah. What do you want to do?
Well,
blast through for, because we don't want to have
I do want second. You to, I know we've talked about it before on the show, but I do want you to talk a little bit about how the dry aged duck thing is going. Mm-hmm. Personally, I'm really excited to talk about the sablefish dish because it's like my favorite. I haven't had sablefish in a long time.
Is that right? Yeah.
And I love it. And yeah, I'm curious to talk about that. I don't know. Maybe either we can skip a couple courses or we can go through the courses quickly. It's your call.
Do you want me to, how about I read them all, but then let's talk about sablefish and ratatouille and the other ones we'll just leave. Is that okay? Or
Yeah, that's totally fine.
So,
because we've already talked about the dry aged duck breast, I guess. So,
okay,
that's fine. Okay.
So the mains, we have dry aged duck breast with buttered grains, beet, sour cherry, duck jus, and puffed wild rice. That one's cool because the sour cherries are ones that I grew. Hee hee. And we make a sour cherry fluid gel with them. That's really tasty. The fish offering is wild BC sablefish with white bean puree, green beans, citrus beurre blanc, almond chorizo crumble. Our vegetarian entree is ratatouille, which I'm excited to tell you about. The descriptive copy is tomato, zucchini, eggplant, chickpea hush puppies, pickled fennel, and herbs. We have a honey and lavender glazed chicken with fennel potato puree, French carrots, black kale, and an Herbes de Provence crostini. And then Alberta beef, a rotating butcher's cut with pomme paisson, broccolini, mornay, and pickled mushroom.
Right. And that's the same pickled mushroom that's like making an appearance in the mushroom soup. And then also it's the pickled vegetables on the rillette.
That would make sense. We've actually changed.
Oh, but it's not.
We've made it's basically like a mushroom relish. I just thought pickled mushroom sounded better on the menu. But it's
gotcha.
Like, cremini mushrooms that are sauteed so they're golden brown and then chopped and mixed with like pickled onion and pickled coriander and sherry vinegar and stuff like that. So
cool.
Sablefish. We're getting nice little IQF fillets of sablefish.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So they're boned out already?
Yeah, they have that little J cut, bones removed, skin is still on. We just trim them up
And they tend to be in pretty good shape. I think that's sort of the problem. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You mean specifically with those pin bones, right? Yeah.
Yeah. With the cuts and the pin bones, like they can get like, I don't know. It used to be hard to get ones that if they were already boned out, mm-hmm. didn't look like they'd been murdered.
Right. So, and if anyone doesn't know, so like, unlike say with salmon, where you can just use tweezers and easily remove the pin bones from the flesh, with sablefish, The bones are in there and you can't pull them out without absolutely destroying.
You have to cut them out with a knife.
Yeah. So you cut them out.
So you basically, you use a knife to cut a line along the whole line where the bones are. And then you basically, in some cases, if it's a big enough fish, you just split the fillet there where that line is, mm-hmm. or you cut on both sides where the bones are and cut underneath and pull the whole bones right. out. And then
it's almost like you're cutting the side ribs off of a slab of pork belly, kind of like you're cutting along those bones. You have to do it on both sides because they're embedded vertically in the flesh of the fish.
I guess horizontally as the fish is swimming, but vertically as you have it on your cutting board.
That's right. And the quality, of the knife work from the ones we're receiving is excellent.
Well, that's good.
There still is, like, obviously you can see that where the bones were removed, but we're serving it skin on.
Yeah, obviously.
And so the skin keeps the flesh intact and it's presented skin up. And so even the right. front end of the fillet that has where the bones have been removed, I think the diners are none the wiser, like because they don't ever get to really right. inspect that side of the fillet. But yeah, it's a very good product. And yeah, it's a fantastic fish, right? It's super fatty. It's so fatty that
so
people
good.
Are always surprised at how moist it is, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of the thing. And like, that's what happened to me with it too. But then I used it a lot. And then I found like lots of different ways to cook it where you can kind of like play off of that fattiness, like poaching it in different ways or pan roasting it and is like probably the most popular way right. that it gets served. But yeah, it's amazing. I love it.
And so for the dish, like because it's such a rich, fatty fish, we knew that we could do, first of all, it would stand up to starch really well. It would stand up to acid and some more robust ingredients that maybe you wouldn't typically put on a fish dish. So like we have, we have chorizo on this dish and we have starchy white beans
right.
and a really tasty citrus beurre blanc. One thing... When students are, not all of them, most culinary students are really scared of beurre blanc because they find it finicky and they go in with anxiety about it breaking and stuff like that.
Right. Or they think that they've made it correctly, but it's actually broken right. and you point it out to them and they're like, I don't really understand the difference. Right. You're like, okay, well.
One tiny trick that we've introduced that actually I picked up from Naramata Inn was like sometimes like the two principal ways that the sauce gets broken is that they don't control the temperature of the melting butter correctly. And so either the liquid in the pot are much too hot or they're not agitating it enough or whatever. But the other thing is just the balance of the liquid component, whatever your acidic reduction is, and the butter. And so instead of a traditional beurre blanc recipe where it's like, start with, you know, a half cup of liquid and reduce it to 2 tablespoons and then start whisking in your butter. What we do is we treat it as a few different prep tasks. One of them is make the citrus reduction. So I can't remember what it is, but it's like start with 2 cups of grapefruit juice and a cup of orange juice and a half cup of lime juice and reduce that to 1 cup. Once that's done, put it on your prep cart. That's your citrus reduction. And then cube up a whole bunch of butter and then... Once your line is set up and service is about to start, take 1/4 cup of your citrus reduction, put it in a pot, bring it to a simmer, turn the heat off, and then start to whisk in 1 pound of butter. So we've kind of separated it where it's like, it's always going to be the same citrus reduction. You're always going to take 1/4 cup of it and emulsify 1 pound of butter into it. And I think that has helped a lot. Especially if you're then, if you're then able to watch them and like show them the agitation that's required, show them like how you want to see the butter melting, but you know, you need to be adding more butter before it's fully melted and that kind of thing. So,
yeah, there's a couple other tricks that I find are helpful as well. Like especially for making larger batches of beurre blanc, what tends to happen is like, you need to put a lot of cold butter in there. And so you need to keep the heat on the pot a little bit. Otherwise you wind up with a tepid sauce by the end, right? Because you're adding a large amount of cold butter into a small amount of hot reduction. So you need to keep the heat going while you're whisking in the butter. But while you're keeping the heat going and whisking in the butter, you're getting evaporation. So that balance that you were talking about between like the liquid component and the fat component is going out of balance because you're losing the liquid to evaporation, but you're not losing any of the fat. So you wind up with too much fat versus the amount of liquid. The way to potentially control that is by using more liquid in the beginning with the idea that you're going to lose some of it to evaporation while you're making the sauce. Right. So that's probably the best and most common way of addressing that. But one trick that I've used in the past too is like when you chop up your cold butter, you put it into cold water.
Oh, really? Okay.
And then you have on your station all of your cold butter suspended in cold water, and you just pull it out with like a gloved hand or whatever to add it to your sauce. But while you're adding it to the sauce, you're also getting a little bit of additional moisture that's clinging to the outside of the pieces of butter. Mm-hmm. And that can help to like reintroduce a small amount of water that like, you know, continually keeps that balance in check, right, or whatever, mm-hmm, is a method that I've used. And then I've also used stabilizers, but using stabilizers is dangerous too, because you can put yourself in a situation where the balance isn't correct and the stabilizer is holding it, but just, right, and then if the balance goes out of whack, then, you know, because you don't want to use a lot of like stabilizers in your beurre blanc because it makes it feel like it has the wrong texture. Right. So you're using a very small amount of like xanthan or something, mm-hmm, but then, you know, that only helps a little bit, but it gives you enough leeway that you can make a sauce with the balance out of whack. And then,
right,
you know, after keeping it warm on your station for a minute or two, it'll start to split because you don't have the balance correct. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm, how are you? Are you making small batches and holding it? Are you hot holding the beurre blanc?
Yeah, we usually make that 1 pound batch because that's about, it's about 15 or 16 portions. And so that is usually more than we need for a single service. And then we have a running, like at the end of service, we'll have them pour out the, so we're preheating a thermos with water from the tea spout.
Okay. Yeah. So you're holding it in a thermos.
Pouring it out and then, yeah, just keeping the thermos by the steam table.
Yeah, that's the best way to do it is in a thermos.
And then we'll have a few, depends on the service, but we have maybe a few ounces or a half cup of that sauce left over at the end of service. We pour it out into a deli cup or a Cambro and just like slowly accumulate it. And then once we have another pound of the leftover beurre blanc,
leftover sauce,
that's that day, that's the, we'll just re-emulsify that and like remelt it and all that. So yeah,
cool. And then after that, nobody's afraid of beurre blanc anymore.
That's hopefully what we're trying to do, is make them not scared of it. But
yeah. it's not that scary, especially if you're like given permission to add a little bit of liquid, if it starts to feel like it's splitting or something like that. When you start pointing out the ways that it's fixable, mm-hmm, like which it is, it's imminently fixable. So that's sort of like, you know, I sometimes it's only fixable by like totally cooling it off and then re-emulsifying it. But, you know, it always is fixable. Mm-hmm. I feel like people are the same way about hollandaise. Scared at first, but once you realize that there's basically no way to screw it up so that it's not fixable, well, I suppose there is a way, but...
Challenge accepted.
Yeah, I mean, if you scramble the eggs, yeah, I wouldn't probably try to fix it, but... Yeah, well, I'd really like to come in and try that.
Okay.
Because I haven't had sable fish in so long.
Do it.
But if I come in and have a main, really I should be trying the dry edge duck breast.
Probably.
See, this is the problem.
Yeah, it's a dilemma.
Yeah.
And then maybe, yeah, just the last one that we can talk about in some detail is the ratatouille, because we wanted to have the kind of striking presentation that you see in the film Ratatouille, and that is kind of sort of from the first French Laundry cookbook, but there it's called Confit de Bialdi, I think.
Right.
But, and so basically the recipe is you have sliced onions and peppers, and I think maybe garlic and herbs that you sweat and then pour into the bottom of a casserole dish.
Mm-hmm.
And then you very thinly slice green zucchini, yellow squash, Roma tomatoes, and Japanese eggplant that all have, mm-hmm, more or less the same diameter round cross section. You toss those with olive oil and herbs and garlic, and then you very meticulously shingle them over top of this pepper and onion mix in the casserole. You cover it,
right,
you bake it to kind of half steams, half bakes until the veggies are tender. And then they lift those shingled vegetables out and kind of artfully set them, I think using a ring mold, kind of artfully shingle them around the ring mold.
Right. Kind of like make a fan sort of presentation using the shingled vegetables.
Yeah. They kind of, I think that like in the movie presentation, I don't know if this is the directions that are given in the cookbook, but they almost set them like they're partly vertical, like so that they have, mm-hmm, kind of vertical shingling effect. And then they're topped with more, like the very top has some horizontally set. But I kind of struggled to at the start, like, how do you do that for an a la carte service? Like, do you just have those shingled vegetables on your line and you warm them up in an oven and then you just like place them in a ring mold as you're plating or what?
I think that's usually, yeah, I think you keep, you know, like you have it shingled in that casserole or whatever. And in that casserole, there's maybe like, well, depending on the size of it, could be like 10 servings in one sort of like baked, yeah, dish or whatever. Yeah. And yeah, you cut them up ahead of time. So you put a knife through them so that they're pre-portioned, mm-hmm, but then you could, yeah, theoretically hold them warm. And then you pull out a portion and you put it, lay it flat on the plate, like horizontally, mm-hmm, but then you push it together. And then that, like pushing it, kind of like you sort of
makes
like
it stand up, kind of
push it from both sides. And that pushes the shingled vegetables up in the middle, mm-hmm, and sort of like makes this kind of like shark fins, sort of like fanned shingle motif in the right middle. You have to do a little bit of cleanup on your plate after that, or use some kind of garnishes to cover up the part of the plate where you put it down and then pushed it in. But yeah, I think that's the technique.
What we ended up doing, so you bake those vegetables as I've described, and then you chill it down, and then we take ramekins and we lift up the shingled vegetables and then press them into the interior of the ramekin. We put a little, fill that with a little bit of the pepper onion mix from the bottom of the casserole, and then kind of close it off with more of the shingled vegetables. That goes to the entremetier line. When we get an order, they pop that in that ramekin in the oven for 12 minutes, and then they can turn it out. Like, they pass it to the chef and we just turn it out upside down. But you have the really clean presentation of the shingled vegetables, and it's like kind of molded to the shape of the ramekin. So it looks pretty sharp, and it's super easy for service, right? It's just like you bake it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Bake it and unmold it.
And then we take whatever's left of that pepper and onion mix. We just puree in the Vitamix, season it. And that's kind of the sauce that accompanies the vegetables. The eggplant hush puppies. I had this recipe that I had done for catering events that was chickpea hush puppies. And because we always want one vegan entree, I just had to adapt that because my recipe had buttermilk and egg in it. And one thing I learned doing this, I was trying to ask one of the patisserie instructors, like, if they had egg replacement, like a vegan egg replacement. And it's kind of like you have cup for cup gluten-free flour. If there was something similar for eggs, because I know you can make flaxseed eggs or whatever, but I was like, because there's just something in the lab next door that I could just take. They didn't have that regularly, but he said that just pureeing soft tofu for this kind of application, like, it's a quick bread, it's not too finicky. Just puree soft tofu and add the same weight as you would egg. And so I had never heard of that before, but it works. And we now have our vegan, gluten-free chickpea hush puppies as the starch component.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Yeah. I'm always curious about that because, like, I always feel like, you know, the egg component in any kind of like baked good is part of like what's going to give it structure, mm-hmm, right? And the reason why it gives it structure is because you put it in raw, and then when you bake it or cook it, fry it or whatever you're doing with it, then you're cooking the egg proteins. And so the proteins are coagulating and setting up inside the product. Mm-hmm. And so that's what's giving it structure. And so the idea to me of like adding tofu, which is already coagulated, doesn't seem to make sense, right? Because it's already gone through that process, mm-hmm, right? And then you're just like breaking it up. But I guess, like, you know, the flour is also giving it structure. And so maybe in a lot of those cases, the egg is just adding moisture. And definitely I could see the tofu working in that capacity. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm, yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. I thought you were going to say aquafaba.
Right. Yeah.
Because that's a stand-in for egg whites in a lot of like drink applications.
Oh, okay.
Because
it can foam. Because
it foams. Yeah. 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 Well, and there's already chickpeas in the recipe, but I, so I was like, oh, that's probably what I would have tried. Mm-hmm. But yeah. And you're pretty happy with how that dish is coming out, hey?
Yeah, it's selling surprisingly well, because usually, I mean, it's still a vegetarian entree, but you can tell that there's definitely people who aren't vegan and gluten-free who are ordering it just because they're curious, but yeah.
Yeah. Do you think, I don't know, I always wonder, like, you know, is ratatouille like a different thing in people's minds now than it was like 20 years ago because of the movie?
Well, I don't think not very many people would have been familiar with it, I don't think, before the movie.
Right. Yeah. That's, yeah, exactly. Which I think is really weird. It's sort of like, yeah, I don't know. The movie makes a point of saying that it's like taking this peasant dish, like, you know, the sort of like the heart of the movie is like, you know, this like humble food, and it's a humble chef, and it wins over this like black-hearted critic, right, or whatever. Yeah. And yeah, I sort of think that like in the real world, it elevated people's perception of ratatouille from being like what might be perceived as being a humble dish to something that's more like fine dining, right, or something. Yeah, totally. I don't know. I think it's a weird dichotomy, yes, there. Mm-hmm. Anyway, anytime I see it on a menu, now I always think of the movie, because I have a hard time shaking that as being like my favorite food movie. I didn't rewatch it recently, mm-hmm, but I watched a YouTube video of someone that like reacts to movies, right, who I enjoy their content. Mm-hmm. And it was, man, it was such a great react video. What's her name? Oh, Natalie Gold.
Okay.
So she does like a lot of, I think she like plays some games and stuff on YouTube too, but she does a lot of like movie reactions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't watch all of them, obviously, but I watched the Ratatouille one, and she went in very skeptical. And by the end of the movie, she was crying. Right, and yeah. I was like, ha ha. I was like, that's why it's my favorite.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.